I just always remind myself that at the end of the day, organizations are human. It's just a bunch of people working together to try to create something that they could not produce alone. And when you do that, you're just reminded around where does change really start and what really drives it.
Welcome to the IDOU Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hello, and welcome everyone to the Creative Confidence Podcast, where we talk to experts about creativity, leadership, innovation, and growth. I'm Kalita Stafford, a partner at IDEO. I am thrilled. I'm so excited for our conversation today. We will be speaking with our very own Deirdre Sermonaro and Brian Walker. Welcome, Brian. Welcome, Deirdre.
Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
We're so excited to have you. We got a lot to cover today. We're going to be talking with them about change leadership, including things like stakeholder mapping, what it is and how to use it, and how to surface insights with your stakeholders. We're also going to talk about the role that skeptics can play in change management or change leadership. Let me start with a bio, intro to Deirdre. Deirdre is an executive design director and leads the systems and strategy practice at IDEO. Much of her work has focused on designing education systems, such as reimagining student services at a community college in Ohio to deliver, this is amazing, affordable education at scale in Peru. She's a former architectural designer, and she's a background in business and psychology, holding an MBA from Yale. Brian is a partner and managing director at IDEO, and he leads the transformation business, where he's worked side by side in organizations such as Conservation International, Nike, Aspen Institute, among many others. Brian's work is widely recognized and featured in publications such as Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, and the New York Times. He also likes to spend time lecturing at Cornell and Stanford. Brian holds degrees from Cornell and Oxford. We are so excited to have the two of you. So let's dive into this topic. Both Brian and Deirdre, by the way, are instructors in our newest certificate around this topic. So Brian and Deirdre, what are some of the themes you're hearing from folks surface today when it comes to leading change? Brian, I'll start with you. What's a couple you're seeing?
A few I'm seeing is resistance. I see some arrogance here. I see one that is actually popping up more and more, probably starting about 2 years ago or with the pandemic. And it's really that notion of change fatigue. It's always been a thing of just too much change, but particularly now you see that coming up over and over again. So those are a few that really pop out to me.
Wonderful. Deirdre, how about some that pop up for you?
The one that really popped out to me was fear, a lot of fear of the unknown, fear of what's coming. And also just people like not understanding or not open or not having a change mindset.
So I know these are not intimidating topics for Brian and Deirdre. So why don't you help all of us think about how we too can navigate and lead to change, given all of these realities? They're very real. Could you talk about your approach to change? What is the mindset and how you kind of enter these spaces? Deirdre, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. Thanks, Ko. Experiencing change can be really overwhelming and is also necessary, which means some folks are leading that change, and that can also be really overwhelming and daunting. And in my practice, there are two things that really help. The first is taking a really big step back to look at the whole picture and really understand, like, what's the context of the moment? How are people feeling? What's the context of the organization? And the second thing is to really zoom in and understand the needs of people in that moment. What mindsets are they coming in with? What change did they just experience? And these are really the two core tenets of an approach called human-centered systems thinking, where you borrow from the analytical tools of systems design and systems thinking and the creative methods of human-centered design. So it helps you to both see the big picture of what's going on and all the nitty-gritty details, and then to really understand and start with the needs of people in the system so you can effectively plan for change and get out of that analysis paralysis mode of what happens when you see the big picture and understand where to start. And that is starting with people.
Wonderful. Can't say that enough, starting with people. All right, Brian, share some of us. How do you start? How do you kind of enter this space?
Yep. I suspect Deirdre and I will have some similar takes on things. When you really think about an organization, it's just a system, a human system, but it's one form of a system. I think Deirdre often is applying a lot of her thinking to even broader other systems. But I really got excited about organizations and really honed in on those as the thing that I've cared deeply about maybe for the last 10, 15, 20 years or so. And it's largely because I really do believe that organizations are one of the primary vehicles in which we shape the world around us. So I really wanted to understand, how do they work? How do you design them? How do you evolve them? How do you begin to change them? And in doing that, it's very easy to overly complexify it, where you start geeking out on structures and processes and policies and norms and cultures. And then you go into like subcultures and substructures and da-da-da-da-da. But whenever I find myself doing that, I just always remind myself that at the end of the day, organizations are human. It's just a bunch of people working together to try to create something that they could not produce alone. And when you do that, you're just reminded around where does change really start and what really drives it. It's not these systems that we put around ourselves. In fact, those tend to actually push more conformity rather than change. But change always is about people. And it's people that have a vision for a better future, people that begin to show the way forward and that change is possible. People that begin to evolve those systems around us in order to have them enable new ways of being. But so my kind of approach to change and philosophy around change is that people are the change.
Love that. And just so people don't misconstrue what you say, there is a role for processes and structures and tools though, correct?
Certainly, right? It's like, I think Winston Churchill has the quote, like, we shape the buildings around us, and then thereafter they shape us. And what it really does is a lot of these processes and these structures, they make collective behaviors and beliefs easier and more normative to do. The challenge, though, sometimes is we aspire to new things, or there's new possibilities that emerge, and we want to do things differently, and things that our existing systems were not designed to do. And that's when those systems can sometimes work against you, but you have to just remember that we created these systems, so we can recreate them. But they definitely have a critical role in terms of efficiencies and scaling and normalizing stuff.
Hey everyone, Ko here. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. I just wanted to tell you a bit more about IDOU. We're an online school where anyone can learn to solve anything creatively. If you're curious to go deeper into the topics in this podcast, our online Change Leadership Certificate teaches you how to use human-centered design approaches to create impactful change. You can learn more about the certificate at ideou.com/changecert. That's ideou.com/changecert, changecert. Now, let's get back to the conversation. The heart of it, and what both of you are saying, it's people. It starts with people. All organizations are made up of people. They are living systems. So one thing that we want to talk about today is one tool, of which there are many, successful change efforts. One tool that I've heard both of you talk about is this idea of stakeholders and stakeholder mapping. And it's really about figuring out, you know, what are the needs of those people, how to incentivize them, how to think about champions and bringing other people along. So I'm going to start with you, Deirdre, and you actually teach this in depth in the Human Centers Systems Thinking course. It's called a stakeholder map. Can you explain it to us? It's going to be brief. You don't have to give us the whole lesson, but like the high level, what is it? How do you use it?
Sure. So systems maps in general are super important tools in systems thinking. Systems thinking is all about taking in all of this complexity. And these maps are tools that can help you actually have a tangible starting point. So one type of a systems map is a stakeholder map, sometimes also called a network map, which really enables you to see the people in the system and the connections between them. So it's really helpful for understanding the broad landscape, but also for then identifying like who has power in the system, who has decision-making power, who's really impacted, who's not connected to one another, where are there potentially misaligned incentives, et cetera. So for example, in a hospital system, you might map out patients, nurses, doctors, but also insurance companies, policymakers, chaplains, family members. There's so many different stakeholders in a complex system like that. And you might start to map the connections like the flow of money or emotional connection, medical knowledge, decision-making, data. And all of this will give you both a sense of the whole picture, but also start to give you a sense of where there's an interesting gap around opportunity where you might actually zoom in and design something.
That was so succinct. Thank you. And did I hear? So there really are kind of two big ideas. So one is mapping, identifying the who in some way, but I really like you're making a point of the relationships, and it can be anything from power, flow of money, emotions. I think that's where it gets really interesting. So can you say a little bit more about why is this tool so important?
Sure. Systems maps are amazing for two reasons. One is that they, and probably my favorite reason, is that they make it possible to make our internal mental models visible. We're all walking around with different mental models of how an organization works or how that process works. And it's actually, sometimes we're using the same words, but talking about different things. Creating a map like this takes that out of your head and allows you to actually talk about it tangibly with other people. The other reason is that, again, people are at the heart of every system, even our environmental systems like climate, that people are still super important players in that. But oftentimes their needs are understood or even overlooked. So to build on that previous example, IDEO recently worked with St. Jude's Hospital to understand the needs of families seeking treatment for childhood cancer. And patient families in that situation actually end up living in housing on campus for long stretches of time. So that means there were even more stakeholders in that system, like that so-called hospital system also included playgrounds, schools, jobs, and a systems map can help you see that only some of the needs of families are really being met in like traditional hospital spaces of exam rooms and lobbies. So they created entirely new spaces for families to play together or even take a nap between appointments or for a sibling to take a class or for a parent to take a work call. And a systems map can help you see the whole picture, but then say, hey, what's going on here? And design something really tangible.
That was beautiful. Thank you, Deirdre. So a big idea, making it tangible, our mental models, making it tangible, and then being able to really hone in, maybe surface unmet needs or new opportunities or gaps. Brian, this does sound overwhelming. It does sound like a lot. So Brian, I'm going to come to you. Any builds or kind of ways that we can help kind of, what's the mindset of using system maps to kind of keep ourselves not getting too overwhelmed, I would say?
When I was listening to Deirdre, I was reminded of, so there's a fellowship that I teach that is for people in large companies, but they're social entrepreneurs. So they're trying to marry pursuit of profit, long-term social good, and drive an innovation through the organization, which the organization probably wasn't designed to support. And there's always a moment in one of them where you, essentially it's doing these systems mapping that Deirdre is talking about, but the request is for everybody to sit down and first draw, how is innovation supposed to work in your organization? Mm. People usually can bang that out. Like, oh, it's a five-step stage gate process, da-da-da-da-da. Like, they bang it out. And then you pause, let everybody have that, and then you ask them, how does innovation really work in your organization? And it's so liberating for people, and they quickly can begin to map all the people and the different relationships and the workarounds that happen. And that's always that aha moment where it's like, if you're really going to drive change, you don't necessarily have to conform to how the mental model, how it's supposed to work. You probably need to really understand how does it really work. And that's where the being able to visualize that and write that out, I find is always a bit of an empowering moment for people to realize like, oh, okay, actually, I can embrace the fact that it doesn't necessarily work the way it's supposed to be. Instead, I need to embrace just how I'm going to make it work.
Oh, I love that. Brian, just building on that, I've also heard you talk about systems we can think about it in a way that would ultimately design for a pull for people to want to be part of. Can you say more about that and how? What's the role of the map in that?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll tell I'll tell a story. So this is a work we did. This is where work that I learned a ton from. And it was work that IDEO was part of quite a long time ago. It was working very closely with Kaiser Permanente. And there was a project where essentially like the head of a hospital, I forget the exact title that they had.
For those outside the U.S., so Kaiser Permanente is a large healthcare system.
Yes, thank you for that. So picture, you know, big hospitals, that type of stuff. Lots of patients, lots of physicians, lots of nurses. Anyways, the head of this hospital realized that they had a problem with the shift change. So this is when physicians and nurses turn over, a new group comes in, and they really believe that there is some opportunities there for better patient care. Better efficiencies in terms of the hospital management. Well, this person approached us to help design for this. And what they really wanted was, well, can you go figure out the solutions? And then I'll take the right answer and I'll bring it to the necessary sponsors, get approval, and then we'll roll this thing out. And what we were pushing for was, you got to map all the people involved in this, from not just those who approve something like this, but who needs to enact this change and who's going to be impacted by this change. And then we should bring all of them into the creative process from the very beginning in order to figure out the robust idea that works for everybody's needs. They were quite resistant to that at first because they were worried that, in particular, the nurses would be resistant to change because they would have to retrain themselves, the belief that they're fixed in their ways, etc. But they ended up doing it, and we brought everybody in. You know, fast forward to the end, is we ended up with a solution that was much richer, worked for the patient, worked for the nurses, worked for the hospital. But the coolest thing that kind of came out of all of it was the role, how critical the nurses became, not just in the creation of the idea, but then the scaling of this idea across their healthcare network into all these other hospitals. And the reason for that is a lot of nurses travel, and there's a bunch of traveling nurses. And this concept, one of the things that was great about it is it was more enjoyable for the nurses, but it also was more efficient for them. So it allowed them to actually step out earlier when they were done with their jobs. And these nurses that are part of it, they started bringing it to the other hospitals they were in. And in that way, like, we didn't really even have to think through a scaling strategy, because it really met the needs of these nurses and tied into this scaling vector of the traveling nurses. It just began to pop up in different hospitals here and there until it ultimately was adopted across the network.
Oh, I love that story. And I mean, we did kind of introduce stakeholder mapping as if it's like a moment in time, maybe at the beginning, but what you've showed, like, change is a process over time. And part of stakeholder is ensuring there's roles and inclusion of those who will be leading and benefiting from the change, which can happen at multiple timescales.
Yes, yes. And as the change matures, there's definitely different types of challenges that happen. And in terms of the coalition that you've built around this that are really kind of making this movement take hold, you'll see people switch roles and take on different roles. So like you're saying, it's not a just do it at the very beginning. Is you kind of want to keep an eye on that. And hold that map and see how that map's evolving over time.
Well, let's continue on that. Deirdre, I'm thinking you probably have some examples here. Like, can you tell us a little bit more about putting the stakeholder map to use? What does it look like to bring others along as, you know, as the change is evolving and happening?
Sure. Another example, a few years ago, we were working with some partners who wanted to spur innovation and specifically culture change in high schools in the US. And they were trying to understand, like, what are the potential leverage points in a school system where we could add the most value with a single intervention? And so we created a big systems map of school systems. So teachers, students, parents, families, coaches, school principals, school leaders, district offices, policymakers, textbook makers. I mean, the map goes on and on. So this is where the complexity comes in. But one thing that popped out from making the map and tracking all the value exchange in between was that school principals or school leaders play a hugely influential role in schools. In fact, they themselves have access to unique leverage points in the school system. Like they're the only people in the building that can control the budget, the schedule, teacher training, events. But they also have very little in the way of support or resources for themselves or as a peer network for each other. So we saw an opportunity to create a leadership development program to actually enable school principals to design school culture. So we kind of gave them the tools of systems design and systems thinking to understand their own schools. And then that later became the Co-Design Schools Toolkit, which is a publicly available toolkit that is a lot about this understanding the whole system and then how to create specific interventions. And all of that is about co-design and how do you actually do it together and bring other people along in the process of change.
I love that example. And it really emphasizes what you're saying along, Deirdre, too. Like systems mapping is one of the ways you can identify gaps and surface. Is there also, through that, is that example of going back to, how do you think about adding or evolving over time?
Yeah, it's a tool. It's obviously useful at the beginning when you're trying to understand a system, but you're kind of always at a beginning because you're getting new information. And so it's always something you can come back to like, oh, I learned something new. How would that fit into this systems map? Or this is a new person. Let me show them this tool. And it may sound oversimplified, but it really isn't. It like the process of making and showing someone tangible, you have such a different conversation than if you ask, exactly like, how does innovation happen? You have such a different conversation if you say, does it happen like this? Or can you show me how that happens? So it's something that you can also use as you're going along a change process to either like remap what you've learned or to bring other people in and bring new perspectives in.
Love it. So I'm going to go to Brian. And so we've talked a little bit about ideal situations, maybe when there's stakeholders who want the change or they want to get involved. Let's talk about people who may be resistant to the change or maybe are overwhelmed or skeptical. There's a whole range where change can feel, it was mentioned at the beginning, fearful for a variety of reasons. Can you tell us a little bit, Brian, about how you approach bringing others along who may be a bit resistant or maybe concerned?
Sure. Generally, it's not rocket science, but my approach, and it's one that often can go a long way, at least from my experience, is listen. So often when you have the skeptic or you have somebody who's resistant to the change, I can tell you they are probably not going to change until they at least feel heard. A lot of times, it's not that they refuse to change, but they don't want to be changed. They want to be part of the change. And whether or not they have the right idea or their argument is valid, just pause and first start by truly listening, not trying to convince them otherwise, but just listening to them and understanding where they're coming from. So it's as simple as that. I'll tell you a story.
Yeah, give us tips. Give us tangible ways of how we can approach this.
I mean, it's a story that's just how a lot of times we can also create false narratives around other people, particularly the opposition, you could say. And if you just take a moment to listen, you may actually be quite surprised. And a lot of times, those people who you think are going to be your greatest resistance can actually become your greatest allies and advocates. So this is a story with a large NGO, global NGO, working with. They do amazing things. And like many organizations, you know, they have the professional skeptic. They have the individual within leadership that's known to start skeptical on everything. Often that person is brilliant and they're really smart too, and can be slightly intimidating because of the stance that they take and also their intelligence. Anyways, they have their one of those, which you Maybe for some of the audience, you might be nodding your head like, oh, yeah, yeah, I know roughly who you're talking about. Well, anyways, we were tasked with bringing human-centered design into this organization in order for them to better design for local communities so that they can have real positive impacts. And working with a key contact in there, we're starting to build it up. We're having awareness is growing. We're beginning to get some momentum around this. And then they got word that this person was very skeptical and didn't believe that this would work. And so immediately our main contact's response was, all right, well, we got to put an argument together. We got to put a presentation.
It makes sense. Yeah. You'd get defensive. Yeah. You
exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
And it's like, okay, so we're going to convince him otherwise. Instead, it's let's just first meet with this person and listen and hear what are they skeptical of. And the pleasant surprise we learned was they're not skeptical of what we're trying to do. They were actually skeptical that we weren't going big enough, that it was too small to succeed. And really at the scale of the organization, their size and the urgency of their issue is we really had to look at our approach to the change and could you accelerate that? Could you increase the size of it? And this person in particular has a very important role in finance. So that was fantastic that they were looking at it that way. But it just goes to show, it's like sometimes you don't want to jump to conclusions or create false narratives around. You just want to first listen and understand.
It's wonderful. Margaret Wheatley, who's an amazing author and org designer. And I think one of her kind of key principles too is leaders are not about leading. It's about hosting. And I love the simplicity of that. Like it's our job to create conditions to bring in that full range of diverse perspectives in part of the process. So you have a lot of strategies around how to engage people. So another one I've heard you talk about is prototyping and this idea of a beacon for change. Can you share about that? What is that?
Yeah. So think about a beacon as really just a tangible manifestation of the change you want to see. That begins to show the way forward. Often, you might have a grand vision of the change you want, but how can you do something here right now that demonstrates not the full vision, but progress towards the vision and the value of beginning to move in this direction? And that's what you often think of as sort of a beacon. It can take many different forms, that's there, but it really does need to be tangible. It needs to produce demonstrable value, and in doing that, it is going to help more and more people begin to understand what you mean by maybe some larger abstract vision, but also it's going to begin to build belief that like, oh, we can actually do this. Happy to give any examples.
Go for it.
If that be okay. One would be probably the easiest one to understand would be. A big pharmaceutical company or pharmacy in Peru is called Inca Pharma. And the big vision they had was digital transformation. So essentially adopting new technologies and basically unlocking the power of the internet to meet an increase in terms of customer and employee expectations. So, digital transformation, that sounds awesome, but that sounds very abstract.
Abstract.
Yeah. Think of us as like the CVS. They're, you know, on different corners and they basically are a drugstore. So what does that really mean for us? Well, the beacon, what we did was, well, what if a customer didn't have to go into the store to refill their prescription, but rather they could do that by phone and have it delivered to their house, right? You have to develop all sorts of new technology there. You have to create entirely new roles. You have to do this. But we just picked one store, got one moped, used text messaging, and actually began to deliver it to within something like a 10-block radius, the medication for some people. And what was great about that is that took this abstract concept of digital transformation. It brought it down to like, okay, I get it. I get how we can deliver greater customer experiences by leveraging technology in new ways. And then what really began to take hold was then we could also even share some of the stories of some of the customers who actually, because of physical limitations, actually couldn't even get into the stores before. And with those stories and something as tangible as this, people could really begin to rally around this idea of digital transformation and then start coming up with other examples or other beacons of their own that began to create a fuller and fuller version of the big vision.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Brian. And a beacon is a prototype. It has the express purpose of being a beacon, a shiny light that's going to rally. It's going to show the change in a very small but tangible way to create momentum. Like it's, would that, anything to add on that?
No, not at all. I think about the beacon puts the emphasis on what is the impact of being able to create this thing, right? A lot of the impact there is, like you're saying, it's showing the way forward and it's beginning to make that change tangible and increase the belief within your organization about this change because you can actually see real outcomes based off of it. Often, you are having to prototype your way to a successful beacon, creating all sorts of different, like you can imagine with this Inca Pharma example, there's all sorts of different ways in which we could have delivered meds to sort of local residents. And so we prototyped a few different mechanisms, how they could order it, how we deliver it, how we make sure it's done in a secure way, all that type of stuff. We had to prototype quite a bit until we got to the outcome that could really act as a beacon for the organization.
Love it. So Deirdre, I know I'm coming to you next. What about like co-creating solutions with all levels of stakeholders and inviting them in to be involved in some sort of ownership of the vision? Can you tell us about that? Doesn't that sound like an amazing, smart thing to do?
Yes, it absolutely is. Brian says this a lot, but the people support what they create. So the more that you can bring people actually into the process of creating change, the more likely that change is to be successful, adopted. And you end up with better ideas because people have different perspectives. So involving the actual nurses in something that's going to affect them is really different than designing something for them. So there's a lot of design practices that are about co-design and designing with and bringing people into the process earlier. Often that also involves, as much as possible, giving people actual decision-making power in the process too, as well as input. But absolutely, like what we're talking about, you know, stakeholder mapping is one tool that you can use that tangibly works actually to do with other people, because the more people are looking at it, the more you're like, oh, I didn't think about it that way, or we missed this stakeholder entirely, or what if we reverse the value exchange here? So it's a tangible way to do that. And there's lots of tools for how you might bring people in at different parts of the change process.
I just want to emphasize one thing that you said, Deirdre, too, is stakeholders can be a way to express your mental model. I've heard you talk about you can actually do it as an activity with multiple people. Can you say more about that? What does that mean?
We just did this with some clients last week who work in the mobility space, but had different, really different roles in the organization, from like lawyer to product development to sustainability, and asked them to map out different questions that the organization was facing. So from moving toward green energy to, you know, producing a lower cost option, just map out all the stakeholders who are involved in that. And because they all had different perspectives, they thought of different things to add to the map. And almost inevitably watching them, they started to come up with ideas, because you can't help but make that map and be like, oh, those people aren't connected. What if, what if, what if? And so it naturally leads you to ideas, but also you make the map very differently if you do it with a group of people.
This has been amazing. I do have one final question for both Deirdre and Brian, and this is quite simply advice for your younger self. But before we go there, I'm going to just thank everyone for joining us and just share a bit more about the amazing work that the two of you do. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. We've been talking with Deirdre and Brian on leading change, particularly around stakeholder maps and the process of bringing others along. If you're curious to learn more about this, I would love for you to check out our newest IDOU certificate program, which is called Change Leadership. It includes three of our courses. So Deirdre's Human-Centered Systems Thinking, Brian's Designing for Change, and one of my favorites called Leading Complex Projects. I encourage you to check it out at ideou.com/change-cert, as in certificate. That's change cert, all one word. Okay, Brian, I'm coming to you first on advice for your for a younger Brian at an earlier stage in your career.
Advice for a younger Brian, my advice would be stay curious. I think just staying curious forces you to continuously be learning and meeting new people and experiencing new things. And there's just only growth and goodness in that.
It's wonderful. Thank you. Deirdre, how about you?
My advice to younger Deirdre is to trust your intuition. I made a lot of pivots in my career. And if there's one thing I could go back and say to my younger self, it would be to have confidence in my own intuition in those choices. Decisions where left other people scratching their heads because it was not a linear path, but it made sense to me and is how I've built a very eclectic career.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you, everyone, for your amazing questions. And I hope you feel a bit more inspired to try out some change efforts this week. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for joining us. If you like what you're hearing here, you can find so much more by subscribing to the Creative Confidence Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you like to listen. We're excited to keep fueling your creativity.